Okay, so normally I start by asking you, like, what's the one thing you learned you thought was most valuable, lesson you learned, or the thing that you thought was interesting. If you don't mind, I'm going to take a crack at that first.
Go ahead.
So it happens right at the beginning of the podcast, and they're talking about what's going on during their training before they go into, eventually they go into Iwo Jima and fight the Japanese. And somebody says, you know, I'm sick of the training. Let me just send me over there so I can slap like a Japanese soldier. And yeah. My favorite part of this podcast was the person in charge. I don't know. I didn't get his name. I don't know if it's a general or not, but his response to the soldier. And I'm just going to read the note I wrote. And he said, "Hold on, Sonny. Let me tell you a thing or two about the Japanese soldiers. The average Japanese soldier has 5 years of combat experience. Don't forget that they've already conquered half the nations in Asia." This is in the 1940s, keep in mind. "Not only are they better trained than you are right now, many of them are old hands at combat fighting. They have a strict military code they live and die by called Bushido, which literally translates to the way of the warrior. With their code and their pledge to die for their emperor, they will die before surrendering. They are well equipped and are experts with their weapons. They are trained to endure hardships, which would have most of you guys riding your congressmen." That's my favorite line. "I don't like them, but I respect them as soldiers. I learned my respect the hard way on Guadalcanal. They are the world's best snipers, experts at the art of camouflage, and get by on a diet of fish heads and rice.
Yeah.
They will never surrender. Heck, they don't even..." This is hardcore right here. "Heck, they don't even have corpsmen," which are the people that... the medics that go over and help you when you're injured. "If they are wounded, they are considered damaged goods. So, Sonny, mull that over. And don't ever let me hear you complain about your training again. There will be a time when your life will depend on what you learn in the days ahead."
Yeah, that, what a difference between like a seasoned kind of veteran and somebody who like just enlisted, you know, like they don't know what they're up against. And you can kind of see the naivety in his words. Like, "I just want to go and slap them." Like, you're not slapping them. They're not that bucktooth like character
that the propaganda films presented them as.
Like, yeah, these guys are hardcore, man. They're carrying swords and guns, like ready to roll.
To me, there's just a lot of lessons in there. One is, don't ever underestimate your adversary.
Never.
You know, that's a good way to get killed, in war, and then in life, like, it's just a good way to get in trouble or fail at your objective. But not only that, like, the benefits of being hardcore. And I think what's happening is we've heard several Jocko podcasts up until this point that have to do with the Japanese. And then, of course, I'm re-listening to, because Dan Carlin's in the middle of, a multi-part series on Japan. And the more I'm exposed to them, it's like, you know, I very much hold the personal opinion that this general does, that, you know, they deserve to be respect. Their culture is an anomaly. And anytime you come across an anomaly, you should study why it's like that. The idea that they survive on fish head and rice, that they can be, that they'll suffer through things without complaint, where you would be, you know, complaining to a congressman or crying about it on Twitter. Like, I don't know. It's motivating to me. I think there's a lot of upside to exposing yourself to stress, you know, and to seeing how far you can push yourself because of your body's natural response to then rise to that occasion, as opposed to a lot of people where they only seek out comfort. I think that's a bad idea.
Well, the Japanese had this like honor system and an omerta that just wasn't rivaled by the U.S. And I'm so thankful that we actually had the capability to deploy nuclear arms, because like, the more I hear about this army, it just seemed more impossible that we won. You know what I mean? Like, we were definitely the underdog.
Dude, you took the words out of my... I was literally going to say that. Like, the more we study them, I'm like, how the hell did the United States beat these guys?
I have no idea.
What I was thinking.
So, like, in... I'll kind of jump into what I found interesting was in my supplemental reading, because I don't really know too much about Iwo Jima. I know they raised the flag and they talked about it, and Jocko talked about it a little bit through Tatum's book, but it was 18,000 Japanese soldiers occupying the island, and we threw 110,000 U.S. Assets at them. And I thought that was, you know, not to jump ahead, but that's like they were kind of using that guerrilla warfare tactic to keep control of this island. And we had to throw like five times the guys to,
yeah,
to complete
our
mission.
How crazy was it? I was talking to friends last night. I was like, listen, I've been learning a lot about Iwo Jima going through and World War II going through these podcasts. And I go, did you guys know that a typical day of fighting on Iwo Jima to get for the U.S. Army to gather 200 yards, just 200 yards of ground would cost them on average 100 deaths? So that's two football fields and 100 people have to die for you to claim that much land from the Japanese. It speaks to their tenacity, what your point, that we're throwing 100,000 people at, what was the number, 18,000 you said?
18, that, I mean, that's what I read.
Yeah, wow.
But I read different numbers about the U.S. numbers. I'm just taking the last figure. I think it was like 80 to 90K that actually went on the island, and then they had supplemental troops or support troops up to 110. I'm not exactly sure. I just knew that we took a lot more numbers to win this island, which is just a small little island, like just off the coast of China and Japan over there. It was just a couple airfields. Like, it wasn't that big. And yet this was a very, very important part of the Pacific theater, you know? So I guess why not throw everything you have? And it was important to somebody, right? Like, that's one thing I don't understand about the Pacific theater is a lot of little islands held strategic value, you know, that we don't quite understand. But the airfield capacity of that island was the salient point and the salient strategy of that island. So I'm glad we did what we did.
So moving on to another point that I thought was interesting, there's obviously some lessons that you can always like infer. Like they're talking about specifically bayonet training, but I think those lessons can be extracted and applied to other things. But these are the lessons that they were teaching the U.S. soldiers in 1943 about bayonet training. It says, listen, you have to be ruthless, vicious, and fast in your attacks. Never pause until you have won. And then this was kind of a crazy sentence. There is only one winner in a bayonet fight. Make sure it's you.
Absolutely.
And then the second lesson would be, don't wait for an opening, make one. I think that's can be applied to life. Don't wait for an opportunity, make your own opportunities. But in there specifically, they're saying, hey, you know, you have to get, you need to be aiming for their vital organs. So if they're protecting them, like hit them with the in the crotch or the genital area with your gun. And then once they go to cover that area, bayonet them in the stomach. And I'm like, wow, that's such a brutal, you know, again, most warfare, I don't think, like, I'm pretty sure we're going to get to Jocko 21, where he talks with Tim Kennedy. And I'm pretty sure they don't train, they don't use bayonet training in the United States Army anymore, or military anymore. Because if I remember correctly, they talk about that. But it's just, I mean, just imagine that kind of combat where you're fighting with guns and then ostensibly a knife on the end of your gun. Very close quarter combat. It's terrifying.
They've bayonets used to be, I think in like World War One, like the French had a type of bayonet that just was just nasty. It was tri-bladed and the wounds never healed. Even if you just got like a clean little poke with it, it would just ruin your chances of being a good soldier. And I think they slimmed it down to like one blade in World War II, but I could be mistaken. I don't know why they get like, so this is what, another thing that I really want to talk about. And this drives the point of international law on how like, oh, please don't, you know, please don't kill our corpsmen or our medics. Like it's war. Like, why are you going to follow rules when you're killing people left and right? I don't understand why anybody would adhere to international laws in a scrap of war.
I don't think they do.
I don't think anybody does. What's the point of like these summit meetings and like this, that we're gonna put out the Geneva Convention? Please follow the Geneva Convention. No, you're in a war. Like, what's the point of any of these like sanctions or not sanctions, but any of these like these invisible codes that you're supposed to follow. Of course the Japanese are not going to follow. Like, a medic's just going to stick his head out like he's not going to get shot. There's too much randomness and more to actually think that anybody's going to follow that.
Well, the problem is, like, the punishment doesn't come until after the war, if there is any, you know?
Yeah.
In the sense that, like, so from an incentive point, like, a good way to understand human behavior is, like, just look at the incentives and then you kind of direct why a person's doing that. So from the Japanese, like, yeah, they're going to, we talked about it on the Forgotten Highlander, like, they would shoot, they wouldn't mark the POW boats, the hell ships, with the Red Cross. They would do that for only for, like, the, when they were doing weapons, because, you know, you're not supposed to fire at that. But the point being is, like, I need to survive. I need to do whatever I can to survive. I'm not worried about a punishment that may happen in the future if I am actually successful. Like, I may never get to be successful. So to the Japanese, like, yeah, I'm going to kill a medic because that medic is trying to, that medic is helping an injured soldier. I'd rather that soldier die because that's one less, like, asset for the enemy. It's like a, that's the crazy thing about war, because it's, you're being hyper rational about your own self-preservation, and the result is usually, you know, the death of, I mean, it is the death of your enemy. So there's no punishment. There's no punishment above that you can do to above a human than death. So
it's just like, if Japan won, they'd be like, well, actually you cheated, Japan. Like, please, surrender all the islands that we died on. And, like, you know what I mean? Like, what's the point? Like, these so-called reasonable men sat down and was just like, okay, so we all agree we're not going to shoot medics, or we're not going to shoot corpsmen, right? All Americans in the room ran. Okay. like it's just silly that, like, somebody wasted their time doing that, when the simple heuristic of, you know, you preserve yourself while destroying your enemy is the only true law. And I know I'm jumping ahead, but that, like, you gotta go deep in the past to come out with these maxims that still hold true. Like, you can't assume that your enemy is going to play by the rules. You have to assume the opposite, that they're not going to play by the rules. There are no rules. So I don't know. That was just one thing. I know it was just, like, a very small point in this podcast, and it just got brushed by because, hey, you know, this is war. We can't, like, a soldier understands.
I don't know if it's a small point, because I think it's a small point in an ongoing theme that we have. That we've experienced now 19 episodes in, where, like, the way we've referenced this on the podcast before is the lowest common denominator in human conflict is violence. So therefore everything is going to eventually fall back to that. So that's nice you have a rule, that's nice you have a law. I'm not saying you shouldn't, but just understand that, you know, it's not going to be adhered to. Like,
it's just
what
appearance.
It comes down to.
Yeah,
yeah, when it comes down to it, like, humans are going to try to preserve, like, they want to survive. That's, you know, if you look at, like, from the theory of evolution, like, you're supposed to do everything you can. Like, you have an implicit self-interest to survive, so you can then perpetrate, like, your own genetic code down the line. What I did like on this podcast, and what Jocko's doing a lot now, is that he is tying, like, a lot of the themes that we see that are separated by time and by distance and by culture together. So specifically, they talk about, like, one of the most terrifying aspects of war in this podcast that, what's his name? I got to get his name. You just said Chuck Tatum experienced was mortar fire. So Jocko says in about 29 minutes into the podcast, he's like, listen, this is the fear is coming from a complete lack of control of your environment. He's like, we've heard this over and over again, that indirect mortar fire that you can't control is random, and that's the most horrifying thing to everybody.
Yeah, and also the Navy's, like, dangerously close to hitting them too at the same time. Like
blue
there was
on
just
blue.
There's too much randomness from both sides to I don't know, man, to comprehend. Like, I was really upset when the hero Bazalone died, because I thought, like, he was going to be more of a hero in this story, but really he became, like, that martyr that, like, kind of stretched the guys even further into their capabilities, right? Like, seeing someone like that die in front of you, oh man.
And that it's not only how he, it's how he died. He was blown apart, basically. Well, yeah. You're talking about Bazalone. The note I left there was, what's pretty crazy is that he didn't have to be there. He died at 29 years old on Iwo Jima, but Jocko describes him. He's saying, like, this is somebody who already won the Medal of Honor. He's out there taking charge and leading troops. He wasn't required to be there. He could be back at home being treated like a hero, but mm-hmm. here he was back in combat in Iwo Jima leading his soldiers. And, like, that just goes to prove, like, you have to be – I just read a few months ago, or I don't know, like 2 months ago, I read Ray Dalio's book called Principles. And he makes the point that you just, like – he was talking about, like, he's kind of an extreme person. He's been a billionaire for a long time, but now he just handed over the reins to his company. So he feels that the first time he has a little bit of freedom. You know, he's in his mid-60s now, and he feels this is the first time in his life he's actually had freedom. And that sounds, you know, counterintuitive. Wait a minute, you've been really, really rich. You're a billionaire. How do you not have freedom? And he didn't have freedom because he's an extreme person. And he had to, like, basically he lived his life completely dedicated to his work. So even though he had money, he didn't really reap the benefits of that because he was so focused on his work. And the takeaway he has is, like, listen, I'm not recommending that lifestyle for everybody, but you have to be who you are.
Mm-hmm.
And in his sense, like, he understood he wasn't going to be fulfilled unless he was an extreme person. And Bazelon, people like Jocko, people like these Hackworth, all these people that constantly go back when they don't have to. These are extreme people, but they are who they are. And you're like, so from an outsider's perspective, it's like, dude, why'd you just forgone, you know, 60 years of life for no reason? But it's not no reason to them. It's who they are.
Yeah. I mean, with World War II, these guys obviously had just chock full of purpose, right? Like this is a war, you know, out of all the wars that we've seen, this is one war that you could see, like, people really getting behind. And I could see Bazelon just sitting there, like, as they were saying, he was doing these short films for kind of Bond purposes. But he could be, like, he was getting, like, Hollywood and, like, realizing these people are fake. Like, I want to be with the real people. Like, I can understand his point to wanting to get back out there. You can almost feel it, you know, like...
Oh, that is, like, a good point. I didn't even think
his,
about that.
His brothers are out there dying while he's sitting there, like, looking at whoever was, you know, the film industry. I'd be so disillusioned. I'd be like, you know, I am better off fighting. And I think a character like that kind of is. Like, he went out there and you know, obviously this is not quantifiable, but he definitely probably, like, raised... Not that... He just raised just the stakes, like this is why we're doing it. Like, there's so much purpose behind this. Like, this is very important that people would give up the sacrifice, the, you know, and I think it was a big contributing factor to our victories. Like, things like that is just unbelievable. Like,
well, to me, the lesson is you have to find out, like, you have to spend a lot of time studying who are you, like, at your core when no one else is around, like, who are you? And then once you realize that, and it takes, I think, a long time and life experience, then double down on, like, on designing a lifestyle that fits the person that you are. And I think that's the most compatible way to have, like, a fulfilling life. So this podcast has got to be a little shorter today because we're on a tight schedule. But I do want to talk about one more thing before we depart. And it's really a question to you, because we find out at the end of the podcast, and I guess towards the end of the book, that that Chuck gets out of there not because of physical injuries, but because of mental. So he says, our wounds were to our minds. There were no bandages that could be applied to them. There were no drugs that we could take that would erase the images of war that filled our heads. You can never forget the pain you suffered in a place like Iwo Jima. The scars will always be there. He survived 14 days of thinking that you're going to die and seeing your friends get killed all around you. So my question to you, Rob, is this the first example that is World War II the first example where, like, combat fatigue.
It was recognized.
Is that now accepted? Yeah, is that now accepted? Because remember, in World War One, they would just, I think you were the one that said on the podcast, they would just, like, hit you or something, right? They're like,
stop being a coward. Like, yeah, step out of it. It was seen as treason. Like, I'm sorry, it was seen as treason in World War One. And I guess somebody somewhere learned something and it became, I don't know, it like, maybe you can... you can attribute, like, Hackworth and the Hackworth Cup is, like, they started to have this paradigm shift where they realized that you could be damaged mentally. But that's a good question, and this that may be true that World War II was the first time that we actually looked at mental health as a ticket. It's a legitimate reason that you shouldn't be fighting.
Here's the thing. So like we're not too sure. I guess the answer is I don't know. This occurs from the U.S. perspective, maybe in World War II, because they let them out, but I think they also talked about that some people still doubted like the legitimacy of it. But if you think about like that's just it's every culture and every military is going to arrive at the conclusions at different times, right? So what I thought of was like, well, that may have happened in the 1940s in America, right? Maybe definitely more so now. I think people understand PTSD and the mental struggles that people with war. But we just covered last week on One Soldier's War. That was a war that happened in the 1990s from a Russian perspective, and they definitely did not. No. They thought of combat fatigue as a weakness, as a you're a coward, you're trying to get out of war, you're faking it basically. So my question to you is, I wonder how many militaries today, present day 2018, going into 2019, still don't recognize this as something legitimate?
I don't know, man. That's a tough question for me to answer. Maybe I can answer at the end of Jocko Academy, but luckily we'll never get to the end of that.
A question with no answer.
And I think that will spring up over time, because we're seeing different type of warfare. Like, I don't think Al-Qaeda or like ISIS recognizes like, that sort of thing. But yet again, I don't know. Don't know. I think they're fighting with a purpose that anything other than their reason to be there is treason. So I don't know. It just depends on if religion plays a huge factor in the conflict, then I think they're not going to recognize any of that. They're going to look at it as treasonous. But luckily we in the if it's a conflict of a different arena rather than just like religion or strongly held opinions, as we always say, that's going to play. And I think we're going to be stronger because of it, because we're going to have the right people at the right time.
Something we talk about is like strong opinions weakly held, which means, hey, like if you have new information that goes against an opinion that is strongly held, like you should reverse course, like you should be open to new information. I just thought while you were talking, when it comes to stuff like nationalism, different ideologies like communism or capitalism or religion, those are usually strong opinions, strongly held. They're very hard to actually convince and kind of change course on. So yeah, to your point, using the ISIS example, if they feel that there is a there's a religious backing to that what they're doing is literally ordained, ordained by the creator, what they believe to be the creator of the universe, it's really hard to have common sense in there. And something that we're going to get to in Jocko 21, where Tim Kennedy's opinion on that is, the only solution there is good men, highly skilled at violence, which is a hell of a quote. Think about that, I never thought, you think about developing skills for work. Maybe you like to play a sport, so you develop skills there. Whatever skill you're developing in life, how many people go out to be skilled at violence? And I don't mean to perpetrate that skill on innocent people, but now the older I get, the more I think that if you do believe that the lowest common denominator in human conflict is violence, then it's probably smart to learn jiu-jitsu, to learn how to defend yourself with a weapon, of course following all laws in whatever jurisdiction you're in. But just sticking your head in the sand and being like, no, it's probably not, I wouldn't recommend that course.
Well, that's good for philosophy of taking a disadvantage and turning it into an advantage, but also the confidence of self-defense. Like, I get it, but I don't know. I'm too old for that shit. I guess I'm not.
To learn self-defense, I don't think anybody's too old at all.
That was a dumb statement. I turn it around.
You're learning. I mean,
my opinion is weakly held.
No, but you're also learning, how to handle, I know you're doing it for hunting, but just being more comfortable you know, we've talked about this on the podcast. I'm not an advocate for weapons. I just think that, you know, they exist. So you either, it's a technology, something we've talked about before. Like, you know, I look at weapons like a technology, and if other people have that technology and I don't, and I don't know how to use it, then if I put myself in a position where they have weapons and I don't, or I'm not, or maybe I have a weapon, don't know how to use it as well as them. Well, then I'm at their, you know, I'm putting my life in the hands of somebody else. And I don't think that's smart. But anyways, that's a discussion for another day.
If you come into the house, we're not going to roll jiu-jitsu. I promise you that.
Well, yeah, unless they're unless they're unarmed for unarmed for some weird reason. But in not any even case, that. we have to cut this short. I have a tight schedule today, unfortunately. But we will be back very soon. We're talking about Mao Zedong's guerrilla warfare.
It's going to be awesome. It's going to be an awesome chat.
Yeah, it really is. So we'll talk about that next week. Just shameless plug here. I have a podcast called Founders. I was inspired by Jocko Podcast, just like he documents the history of military, the military history through these books. I document the history of entrepreneurship through biographies of people that built companies. So if you're interested in history, entrepreneurship, just weird characters. you can check that out at founderspodcast.com or just search Founders Podcast anywhere you get your podcast. Also make leave links to like Apple Podcasts and stuff like that so you can find the show easily. And if you want to read the book Black Sand, Red Blood, Black Sand. And you want to listen to it and you don't already have Audible, we'll leave a link in the show notes available on your podcast player where you can pick that up for free. All right, that's it. Rob, I will talk to you again next week.
All right, man. Later.